think my time in public service was really blessing because I was able to do these big scale things, from product safety to detecting pandemics and diseases, whatnot. I wake up every day and every morning try to say, what can I do to change this world?
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health.
A cardiologist by training and a data scientist long before it was sexy, Dr. Taha Kass-Hout, who was the first chief health informatics officer at the FDA, demonstrates the outsized impact possible when heart, vision, and passion meet commitment to government service.
This is Tectonics. I'm Lisa Soonan.
And I'm David Shaywitz. And today's episode is brought to you by DNA Nexus, the secure and compliant cloud platform that enables enterprise users to analyze, collaborate around, and integrate massive amounts of genetic and other health data.
Well, I'm really looking forward to this talk today, David, because I think, as you have said, you know, the level of passion and intellect that the government has managed to attract in people like Tahoe is really significant and different than in past years.
I'm really struck by just how much the Obama presidency really embraced technology. I mean, I really think this began with his campaign and his use of data science in his campaign. And then once he was in office, the way he energized the Office of Science, Technology, and Policy, and the way he sort of catalyzed the translation of Silicon Valley insight and people into Washington has been remarkable.
Yeah, it is. And it's great, you know, as some of these people are now leaving office and moving into the mainstream. There's so much I think they can do for the public-private initiative.
I really agree. You know, I got to experience what I hope represents the future of government firsthand when, you know, disclosure at DNA Nexus, I set out to talk to the FDA about how our cloud platform might support their mission. I'd been intrigued by some of the comments I'd seen from their CMIO, who seemed somewhat unexpectedly to speak the language of data science in Silicon Valley. And it turned out that this guy, Dr. Taha Kass-Hout, our guest today, was an unbelievably forward thinker, a leading advocate of data sharing, first at the CDC and then at the FDA, where he had first pioneered the concept of open FDA and then led the development of precision FDA, which, again, disclosure, we've been privileged enough at DNA Nexus to partner with them on. So from day one, I thought it was remarkable and inspiring to see a guy like this in government. And I thought we should also point out that he has stepped down from his role in the summer of 2016. So welcome, Taha. We're so excited to have you. I know Lisa feels like she has to calm me down here.
He's wearing a jacket with your picture on the back.
All righty, yeah. You know what? You by another program, maybe you will too. So we're so excited, obviously, apparently, to have you on the program. And there's so much I really want to talk with you about. I want to really start with this question. How did you first get involved in government service? It was at the CDC, right?
Yeah. So I came around. Well, first of all, thank you so much. I'm a really great fan of your podcast and the great and awesome work you guys always cover. So, and I appreciate all the comments. Yeah, I joined as you said, I mean, I stepped down from the federal government about 5 months ago with my last role as the FDA Chief Health Informatics Officer. But prior to that, for about 4 years, back in 2009, around H1N1, when I joined the federal government to help sort of step up its emergency room coverage for the pandemic and get ready for the second wave. So that's how I joined the government.
You've always been a real champion of both of data sharing and the use of emerging technologies. How did you do it so successfully in what's often regarded as a highly bureaucratic structure that isn't always on the leading edge of change in technology?
Yeah, well, it was almost the perfect storm. As you mentioned, I mean, the Obama administration really emphasized the role of data and data science and innovation and technology to help solve problems. It was always about asking the right question. And once we understood what that question is, it was a lot easier to kind of help people navigate through some of the bureaucracies or some of the existing ways about doing business. I mean, prior to coming to the CDC, I was involved in setting up the first Google startup called Instead. That was sort of like the baby of Larry Brilliant about how can we go after, you know, larger schemes of information already being shared online to help, you know, predict and prevent the next pandemic. And it was very interesting for about 4 years prior to joining the federal government, where we really focused a lot on, you know, that was sort of like in the auspice of Google.org and other things, you know, looking at Google searches, looking at online media and all sort of things, going to Southeast Asia and setting up like a whole structure there. But how can we really go after in some of the most austere places in the world and prove that, you know, if you really focus really hard on what is the problem you're trying to solve. There's a role for technology, and oftentimes, how can you get people together and inspire them rather than influence them about how to work, you know, in that kind of environment and start showing progress. I mean, the whole idea when I came to the federal government, we literally had 6 to 7 weeks to get ahead of the second wave of H1N1. The first wave came.
H1N1 being the flu epidemic.
Exactly. The H1N1, I mean, they used to call it H1N1 event and then became more of like an epidemic. But most health departments didn't know what's going on in emergency rooms because you see it from the front line, front pages of newspapers, you know, school age kids dying in emergency rooms. And CDC had made a huge investments in creating a network around the country. However, the sharing of the data was really lagging behind quite significantly in the prior 8 or 9 years. So when I came on board, I really had to kind of work together with the state and local health departments and associations, hospital associations, whatnot, bring the partners together, get them excited about, look, there is something all of us can do together if we share a little bit of data. And then the barrier to entry, you know, that was reduced quite significantly once you got everybody to agree, and the technology had a really amazing role. We went from few percentages of emergency room visits in the country coverage. Now we have over 90% coverage throughout the country. And I know we started with influenza-like illness, but that model over the next few years really propagated to cover over 200 conditions. And that was also the role I played for bringing the cloud technology for the first time to the Health and Human Services. In the government, and that created, in a sense, that, you know, a different ecosystem, where now you have working in distributed fashion around the country. Any health department, any practitioner will be able to participate because you remove the barrier to technology, and you remove and then the money was spent more wisely on actually hiring people. We generate so many jobs of epidemiologists, data scientists, positions within local and state health departments, and that was the right investment. So this is a really good story about where technology and data science truly was sort of like what helped, you know, achieve a really novel mission.
Maybe I have the story wrong, but I think back like on Google and those the flu trends sort of technology that they started with, which ended up being shut down. So what changed between now and then, you know, that made it useful again? What is it that we learned about how to use data that made it effective for your programs by the time you got to CDC?
Yeah, I mean, you have to look at it as more of an experiment. I mean, like if you look at the flu in a sense, I mean, flu really is more of a mosaic kind of effect. So every data source you bring to the mix is trying to tell you something about the bigger picture. But when you try to force one of those streams to look like another stream, and that was really what originally happened with you know, sort of to help validate and in the public health world, you know, before you look at the signal, it hasn't been validated. But when you try to validate to another signal and then at some point those two signals don't align, it really creates quite a bit of disruption that was unnecessary. I mean, if you look at the original, honestly, the original Google flu trend, and this is, I mean, we can go back to Jeremy and Matt Mohebi about, you know, and all, you know, the original days where we're looking at that. It was really amazing, like, because the original algorithm did really, really amazing until you start kind of pinning it against, is it matching exactly to the CDC's?
Yeah, I mean, my understanding of it was I think the best take on it was an article in 2014 by Alexis Madrigal in The Atlantic, where he points out that actually was really successful, that they deliberately looked at only certain information as part of essentially a control experiment, where they're saying, what can they do just with some aspect of the data alone? And then, of course, when you integrate it, it's better. So everyone's like, oh, it was a failure, but it was actually an experiment that was sort of trying to demonstrate something.
Yeah.
But let me go to a next topic. Again, there's so much to cover in so little time. So I want to take a quick step back into how you got here. I know that you were born in Syria, the son of an architect. You grew up in the U.S. and you loved computers, studied architecture, and then decided to be a doctor, attending medical school in Texas and continuing your training at the BI, the House of God in Boston. How did you wind up in medicine?
Well, I was always fascinated really by the role of computer and understanding the human body. And I caught up, caught with the, I mean, I was programming when I was really in my early teens, using an English computer called the ZX Spectrum, and coding against my TV at home. And it was really where you use a cassette recorder and that sort of thing. And that's how you used to debug the the code and whatnot. I mean, it was I still to this day I still code, but not, of course not in BASIC. But
I think that might be the last language that I wrote a program in. So.
Exactly. Yeah, and it depends whether you have the really right the right recorder or whatnot. But that's really what got me started there, and I always was fascinated. But probably, you know, what happened when I was participating in a clinical trial, multi-center clinical trial with Beth Israel around the world for to look at conventional methods versus optimal atherectomy, and use the Harvard Gopher to sort of connect all these 22 or 24 centers around the world, and where everything was captured electronically and everything analyzed and assessed almost in real time. And this is in mid-90s, which was like the cusp of the internet. It wasn't widely available at that point. So, and that was really sort of what made a far more sort of stronger connection about the value of real-time data to help us sort of make some decisions. And so my venue all around, like how I've been looking at computers and programming computers and even my design, discipline within the undergrad, in my undergrad with design architecture and building architecture really all helped me sort of kind of prepare myself for something much, much more novel.
What was the leap that got you from there to medicine? I mean, that's a pretty different pathway.
It's my passion for science since I was a kid. I mean, it's never changed, but really it wasn't like I picked up computers. If you look at my peers, we're all playing games and Atari and all those kind of things. I was the only person who was actually programming something. And I used to program for physics, used to program for certain things, but I was trying to find like, how can I apply this for something much bigger to help me understand the larger picture. My dad is an architect, and I grew up in his lab and his office for most of my life, and I was always like really driven by engineering and whatnot. But that's something like I really like. You know, it wasn't quite like this is what I want to end up doing in life. But it was something really truly helped me be more structured in my thinking and process. Do a good process design, especially when I was got more and more involved in clinical trials and large population studies.
Wow. So if someone was listening to this, they probably would get the sense, like sort of what a geek, which may be partly true, but you're also a legendary athlete, right? Playing both soccer and tennis at an extremely high level. I mean, even in Davis Cup tennis competitions, as I understand it. It sounds like a pivotal moment in your life was a devastating car crash in Texas. Can you tell us both about that experience to the extent that it's comfortable and then what you've kind of really taken away from that?
Yeah, I mean, it was really good. I mean, as I always say, all my prior experiences really opened my mind. And my parents, I think, did an amazing job to let us do whatever we want. And it got us exposed to so many things growing up. But probably what made me the man I am today was an event that happened close to 15, 16 years ago. As I was visiting my friends back, and I was on a little break and visit my friends in Texas on my way back to the airport early on in the morning, and ended up with a detour where in there was a single lane highway, and it's a really sharp turn. All I can see in my front was a huge grill of an 18-wheeler. Trying to avoid that devastating sort of crash, I ended up hitting a ditch on the side of the road, and that's honestly the last thing I remember. The 4 months later, woke up still in intensive care unit with body cast and everything, and realized shortly after I couldn't even move my legs, and it was quite devastating. But I mean, the happy ending to that was 2 years later with a number of surgeries, even the most recent one about a year and a half ago for spinal fusion. So much physical therapy, which I still do till today. I mean, it's just I was able to get a master of science degree in statistics, and be able to slowly get back on my feet. And I think about 4 or 5 years later, I got back to tennis. I still haven't been able to get back totally to soccer, but I mean, every once in a while, I kick the ball with my two beautiful girls. So
I'm just happy to get out of bed without groaning. So I'm wondering though, as you were already a physician by the time you had this accident.
Yeah.
You know, how was that for you to be a doctor under the care of doctors? What was your experience? Did you take anything interesting away from that?
It was surreal because, I mean, suddenly, like, everything I did on every patient in my life is done on me.
Right.
and including the Babinski sign, which was like, oh, my God, now is that really me, like, happening to? It was just like an out-of-body experience. And and it was really, I remember, there's a huge incision on my, almost a surgical, surgeon cut, so to speak, what they refer to. I mean, for about 2 or 3 years, I couldn't even look at my body. It was, had a very, very severe effect on me mentally and physically, but also taught me resilience. I mean, till today, I mean, like, it really taught me where, you know, no matter how harsh things in life is, how can you bounce back immediately? And that's really the true value of resilience, and be able to kind of have a good support network and focus on building support network between your friends and family that really matters the most at this kind of times. But yeah, I remember like even having students come in like in their third or second or third year, or even nurse students, when I say, oh, can I poke you and do an A-line on you? It's like, yeah, of course, you know. So it's like, maybe it was a poetic justice now, all that I've done to my patients, training that now it's done on me.
Did it change the way you thought about medicine and the way you practiced in your jobs?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it just makes you more empathetic and more closer to really, like, it's a human experience of this. There's no textbook will ever teach you that. Mm-hmm. There's not even, you know, training will teach you that. It was really like, now I'm on the other side trying to and truly understand how it is.
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine. And, you know, I think David mentioned that you spent part of your training at Beth Israel, and that also was pretty influential to you in bringing the data sharing side to medicine. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason I went and got during my downtime a Master of Science in Statistics, actually when I was doing part of Beth Israel, there was this cardiovascular data analysis center. Was right behind the Fenway, which amazing 24,000 square feet. All they did back then in the 90s was just these multi-center clinical trials using this sort of advanced computer methods and that sort of thing. And there was this one statistician that I had so much affinity to because I spent a lot of time with. And that truly, like, if I want to make like the single connection made me really in love and if data science and truly kind of dig deep, was that sort of that relationship that I had with and I forgot her name now, so it's off the top of my mind. But when I went back during my downtime and I got a Master of Science in Statistics, I mean, that really helped me till today, you know, deepen my understanding of the science and the methods behind it, especially when you're trying to conduct large population studies or clinical trials, even more innovatively with crowdsourcing information, which has a lot of biases in it, but yet we were able to show how using crowdsourcing, has helped medicine, has helped population health and public health, and even humanitarian world.
How have you seen the embrace of data science by medicine evolve since the experiences at the Beth Israel that you're describing to what we're seeing today in the context of large-scale clinical studies and other methods of data collection?
I honestly always say, I mean, if I don't understand how any person can be a doctor without really being a data geek one way or the other. I mean, it's you know, making decisions based on experience is great. Making decisions based on what the data is also trying to tell you is even better. It's just a matter about, you know, when you're swimming in the data that we have, are we getting dumber or are we getting better? So what is the knowledge that we can extract from that? And what is the impact that we can help in real time to not only impact the lives of patients, but even detect and prevent diseases down the road? And so almost like, and I wish, I mean, right now there's a lot of focus in medicine about how can, a doctor works as part of a team as opposed to one person. And I hope there's also more and more focus on, you know, how doctors can be also data scientists one way or the other. You don't have to code anything, but just try to truly understand how it can apply the critical thinking, using information that can help you do that. And I see that right now with the Kaiser Permanente new medical school, that there's going to be a lot of emphasis on that.
So here's a related sort of the converse of what you're describing is, you know, you're describing how there's opportunities for doctors to embrace data science and data scientists more. If you had to talk to tech, and you must do this a lot, talk to engineers and technologists, what are there aspects about medicine that you wish you could communicate better to them, that you wish more of the engineers who suddenly find themselves doing health or saying we're going to disrupt healthcare, what about medicine and healthcare you wish they would understand better based on your experiences?
Well, I mean, starting, I think, with the patient experience. If people would spend a little bit more time, you know, like what our patients are going through, I mean, and then try to think about how can we innovate that whole experience, I think there's going to be, I mean, that in itself will help us leapfrog the entire practice and of medicine and beyond. there's very, very little attention is done in that. I mean, it's and also the training, like, you know, I mean, if you're in medical school, you probably get more about 6 or 8 weeks worth of biochemistry training. Can we get more in quality of care training? And then, which, you know, quality is oftentimes driven primarily by the information that you're gathering, whatnot. And just if we can focus a little bit more on that, for both on an engineering side as well as the medicine side.
So I've heard you talk, you know, sort of when you talk about emerging technologies, you seem particularly hopeful about many of the digital health technologies. Could you describe your perspective? I find myself struggling to locate where on sort of the hype cycle we are with some of the digital health, because I feel like there was an initial burst, you know, it's very much like genetics, actually. There's this initial burst of excitement, and then people were sort of brought down to earth thinking, hey, wait a minute, it's not going to be magic. And then, what, you know, hopefully then there's sort of the hard work of actually doing the robust clinical studies to really demonstrate impact. How do you see some of the tools of digital health impacting medicine?
Yeah, so I mean, the reality right now, I mean, you know, since the ACA and the high tech, you know, the technology and medicine sort of were like two separate, you know, entities, right? And they really shouldn't. So it's really great. I mean, part of the Obama's legacy will ever be like, I mean, this is the time where truly we start seeing, you know, digital and electronic records and apps and whatnot, which is really amazing. But if you also look at it, you know, since 2010, close to $20 billion spent in investments and venture, you know, money on digital health apps. But we have over 100,000 apps. Do we really need all those apps? You know, has there been truly qualitative studies done on the effectiveness of these apps and on the intervention of each? So there needs to be a discipline in about how these are rolled out, because otherwise, unfortunately, it's going to be a lost sort of opportunity for us to truly monitor health and be able to kind of engage customers, meaning patients and doctors and clinicians and other things. I mean, there are certain trends about, you know, for example, if you look at Kaiser Permanente, I mean, about 52% of their visits last year were virtual. That's amazing to start seeing, you know, now where the care is driven outside of the four walls of hospitals and more community being engaged. But we really truly have to understand that world better and be able to sort of have a technology that's trying to solve a problem, but have that also be the intervention be measured and valid and backed by the evidence. So maybe now the phase is really to start looking at the evidence generation about, you know, the effectiveness of these, and maybe that will help us sift through all what's out there. So.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I'm sitting here listening to you. I can't help but think about Moneyball and how sports has embraced technology and data. And then it's considered now, you know, you got to be an idiot not to want as much data as you can. You know, looking at Theo Epstein and, you know, his move from the Sox to the Cubs, and, you know, the success travels with him. And, you know, Moneyball has driven much of that use of data to win. And yet in medicine, I still think there's a great deal of reticence. And there certainly are physicians like yourself that have embraced data as the path to, quote unquote, winning. If you define winning as better outcome. But there's still a great tension around, you know, whether data or human, you know, empathy and knowledge and experience, you know, trumps data. And how do you balance these things? What do you think about that? How do you get medicine to Moneyball, or should you even try?
Yeah, no, I would definitely try. But perhaps you can look at it from a couple of things. I mean, if you look at the space of medicine right now, there's probably five generations involved. I mean, if you count from folks, but, you know, in their 20s all the way to over 80s, you know, between folks that are either entering the care right now or heavily involved or the you know or about to retire and still doing that, and those are about five or six different generations in a sense about their acceptance to these things. I mean, even within the millennials, I mean, there's those on the edge. There are those who are heavily, you know, there, and the expectation there is different. I mean, right now, for example, my generation, if I go, and I'm generation, I guess, X, if I ask, you know, if I need to ask someone, it's like, if somebody asks me about, like, you know, do you have a, you know, do you recommend a cardiologist? I say, yeah, I know X, Y, and Z over there. You know, but if you look at the millennial, I mean, they're doing their homework. They're going at the Health Grade, the USA News. They're looking at the reviews. They're even looking at the Yelp reviews. It's a different sort of engagement for those. So you have this kind of, you know, generational, you know, different ways about about how we can tailor the information to those. But then the reality is, you know, when you're practicing, you know, I think when the world was fee-for-service model, we built the perfect electronic health record system for that world, which was billing. So you have a great, amazing, awesome billing system, but that's not a value. You can't get value out of that. As a matter of fact, about 10% what drives outcomes for patients downstream is driven by EMR data, 70% by consumer-generated data. And that's a totally different culture, different way as we move into this new world. And then about 20% genetics, if you care about precision oncology right now.
So what's the example of this consumer-generated data that, from what you're saying, sounds like we should be paying greater mind to? What's an example to make it real for us?
Yeah, I mean, some are like low-hanging fruit, the ABCDs, aspirin, blood pressure, cholesterol, smoke cessation, diabetes treatment. I mean, those are more of a, you know, right now there's device. I mean, I can monitor my blood pressure. I can do things. I can be more active. I can see, you know, I need to go on exercise more or diet differently. And those are becoming more of engagement tools, but also ways I'm collecting information about myself that I can tailor my treatments or can tailor my prevention or can learn more about my history, especially if you add some genetic data. Genetic data probably is still further out there, I mean, from the full picture of practice. But it's there right now. You might learn about the ancestry, but you might also learn about some risks that you might be able to do something about beforehand, especially if you tie that back to family history. So, I mean, it's, yeah.
So I know we're closing in on the end of our time, but there really is one other topic I wanted to discuss. So as a Syrian American who has spent so much of his life in the federal sector in the U.S. and served the country with such distinction, some of the rhetoric of the recent election season must have been just absolutely maddening. Can you tell us about what your experience has been like in this regard?
So, it's truly, as a U.S. citizen and born in Syria, it's been very, very difficult because it saddens me just to see all this hatred and discrimination that's going on and how the political agenda is being played around that. It also saddens me that people was just, one broad stroke of labeling that suddenly all immigrants and refugees are really really bad people. Perhaps what's happening in Syria right now, honestly, is evidence of some of that. I mean, I've been subject to discrimination until today, even in the workplace, regardless where you work. I mean, my name is Taha, not Paul or John, and folks really try to sort of give you a different kind of treatment because you're they consider you're not part of here. But I'm sorry, like I have 8 years worth of public service. I feel I've done amazing work and innovative way about how I impacted the health and safety of products and people around the world, and I was blessed. I think my time in public service was really blessing because I was able to do these big scale things, from product safety to detecting pandemics and diseases, whatnot. So and I feel really, you know, it's bad that people label you as not non-human. Basically, I mean, I wake up every day and every morning try to say, what can I do to change this world?
And one of the ways that you're doing this is with this project that I know, I believe actually your wife may be leading it, called Humanity Tracker. Could you maybe just for the very end here tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so 5 years ago, my wife, Hind, and I stood up Humanity Tracker. It was, how can we give a platform or a forum for anyone around the world to tell the story about themselves, what's going on around them? And we adopted also like a platform that was now is open source, the machine learning and data mining, but it's a global platform, but in the case of Syria, has become one of the most trusted sources of information around Syria or the Syria crisis, whether inside the country or outside around the world. I mean, just last month alone, Humanity Tracker was selected from several thousand global solutions submitted to the United Nations as the top innovation for 2016 United Nations Solution Summit for Global Sustainable Development. I mean, Megan Smith, the White House CTO, was they co-hosted the event. So it's really amazing to see how an idea came, you know, how 5-6 years later, you know, this whole method and the same way data science and citizen engagement and crowdsourcing, all those techniques where we're able to look at a different type of a crisis that was going on, which many have labeled to be like perhaps the second Holocaust of our humanity.
Is it like Twitter for stories for people, you know, around the world experiencing humanitarian crisis? What is the exact purpose of it, so our listeners can understand?
Yes, I mean, there's a mining component of it where we mine social media and open news and whatnot, but there's also more of a human element. People on the ground, like for example, if you look what's going on in Aleppo right now, totally besieged place, and people are taking videos and sharing with you, and they're able to corroborate those. And they're truly telling them, they're telling you their story day by day. Imagine now we have an evidence on that for the last 6 years. I mean, from needs to development needs to human rights violations to killing to rape to diseases to whatnot, and across the board, just from what people directly are telling you, this is what's going on, and trying to tell the story. But the secondary sort of benefit of this, now you have a huge evidence that you can help relief and development needs. You can help create even like an international policy groups whatnot have used, especially like USAID, Department of State, even the White House have looked at the data and used it in their public briefings and official reports. Actually, there was an article by the Washington Post a couple of years ago where around to cover the refugees, where they use every UN organization as a credible source. And then at the end, they said Humanitarian Tracker is also one source of information.
It's like you're back to the flu tracking, only with a different topic in a different way.
Exactly. Exactly. The very first time something like this, where they actually use crowdsourcing as an evidence.
Very interesting.
Wow. I mean, I think it's tragic that there's a need for that. But given that there is, it's just another example of just the real good work that you're doing, and that sort of good that essentially good technology, good intentions, and good people working together, what they're the benefits that they're really able to drive in the very best sense. So it's just, again, so inspiring, and we're really grateful you're able to share these, this ultimately, I would say, hopeful and inspiring stories of people and technology with our audience.
Thank you, Lisa and David. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being on the show today, Tahoe. It was really interesting to listen to you talk.
Thanks.
So I was sitting here, David, listening, and had this sudden revelation that, back to the Moneyball analogy, you know, the great American pastime, baseball, right? You could not have baseball in this country without immigrants. You could not have baseball without Hispanics and other cultures now who are the stars of the sport and who we laud as our great American heroes. And yet the political discourse is so the very opposite of that.
It's stunning. And I mean, particularly, you know, from the perspective of being a sort of in Silicon Valley, and you see how many companies were built by immigrants, and I mean, it seems like, I mean, frankly, it seems like an absurd conversation to even be having. But I think that he's just so much the embodiment of just so much that's great and good about the country. It's always inspiring.
Well, I mean, public service in every sense of the word, you know, actual, vocational, and real.
Absolutely. So Taha Kazhout is a physician and data scientist and was the first chief health informatics officer at the FDA.
We're grateful to our sponsor, DNA Nexus, the secure and compliant cloud platform that enables enterprise users to analyze, collaborate around, and integrate massive amounts of genetic and other health data.
You can follow Lisa Soonan at VentureValkyrie.com as well as on the Timmerman Report.
You can follow David Shaywitz at Forbes.
Tectonics is produced by Connected Social Media and recorded in Tectonic Studio B in Mill Valley, California. Take care.
Be nice to people.